ID, the Future, a podcast about evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to ID, the Future. Do we need a new theory for how life began? I'm Eric Anderson, and I'm joined again today by Dr. Brian Miller, Research Coordinator at the Center for Science and Culture at Discovery Institute in Seattle, Washington. Dr. Miller holds a PhD in physics and has been a contributing author to the recently updated and expanded volume, The Mystery of Life's Origin. Thanks again for being on the show, Brian.
Hey, thank you. It's a pleasure.
So, Brian, we were analyzing a recent conversation between Jeremy England and Paul Davies on the show Unbelievable. The conversation was facilitated by Justin Brierley, and the topic was the origins of life. Do we need a new theory for how life began? And so in our prior conversation, we talked a lot about Jeremy England's proposal and the work that he's done on non-equilibrium systems. And we were talking about what's actually needed in practice to have anything get off the ground for origin of life. Tell us a little bit about some of the work that's been done with minimally complex cells.
Certainly. There's a lot of excellent research being done asking the question, how simple can a cell be before it will no longer sustain itself? And people like Venter, people have done that research. And also, at the same time, there has been research by engineers looking at the question of what is the simplest possible self-replicating machine? And people looked at, let's say, a space probe. People have looked at things like self-replicating robots. And what you find is those two streams of research converge such that you see the same functions appearing in both sets of analyses. So if you're going to ask the question, what is a minimally complex cell, you need to be informed both by the biology and the engineering. And when you are, certain functions must be there. Things like you need machinery for energy production and delivery. You need information repositories and processors. You've got to have these selective gateways with active transport that allow certain things into the cell and allow other things to leave. And they have to make sure other things do not leave that are essential to the cell. Mm-hmm. Sensors coupled to signal transduction pathways and signal processing. In other words, the cell has to detect its internal state and most likely its external state and then respond accordingly to maintain a stable condition. You need actuators that can implement instructions. So you have this processing of signals, and you have to act upon it. Mm-hmm. You have to have manufacturing and auto assembly processes. You've got to have automated repair machinery, waste disposal and recycling, and control systems that will coordinate all the processes. So these are really essential at a minimally complex cell.
Yeah. And all of these, I think Davies was emphasizing, are undergirded or controlled at some level, if you want to look at it that way, by information.
Yes. So information, in the most generic term, is that which constrains outcomes or specifies patterns. So what happens is the information is what undergirds everything about a cell. You have, for instance, the information in DNA, which encodes the proteins, the specific sequences of amino acids. You have information in the context of the right lipids being in the cell membrane with the required specificity to maintain a stable cell. You've got to have information in the context of how different proteins are put together to create the right machinery. So this idea of information undergirds everything from the patterns of life, the structures, and even the timing of processes. So a cell has to do the right thing at the right time in response to the right condition. So that's all information in an informational context, not to mention you've got to send signals where you're converting information of one form into another. So for instance, a cell has to sense its internal environment. If something is, let's say, too high pH or too low pH, you don't have enough ATP, it then has to send information to some center to tell the cell to create, let's say, more ATP. So all this is central.
Yeah. And one of the things that England said, which was really surprising, he said, one person's information is another person's noise. How do you assess that statement in the context of what you've just been talking about?
Well, and again, that's the big challenge with England's work, is that he can describe systems that will self-organize in a certain way. But the way those patterns look in those systems is nothing even remotely similar to life. It's kind of the difference between, let's say, a tornado going through a junkyard and creating, let's say, circle patterns of debris. Mm-hmm. That would be a sort of self-organizational process. But that's very different than a car, because a car has very specific pieces in very specific arrangements. In the same way, when you look at a cell, it's not just some generic pattern, like a tar in your barbecue pit, but it's nanotechnology, it's machinery. It's very complex arrangements of molecules that are put in very specific ways to produce specific goals. So what England has to do is he has to sort of talk about life in a way that bypasses that challenge. So he says, well, one person's information is another person's noise. His assumption is that somehow the early stages of life were radically different from what we see today and may have appeared much more generic than life does now.
Yeah, and if we take that statement, one person's information is another person's noise, I mean, you could kind of agree with that in the sense that if I went to a foreign country where I didn't understand the language, you know, it would just kind of sound like noise to me. But that's not because there's not information there. It's because I haven't done the studying required to identify it. And so if you look at a cell, it's very objective that A is doing B and is controlled by C and so on and so forth. This is empirical, objective observations that we can identify. And so, you know, this is not a situation where what's going on is in the eye of the beholder. I mean, it's really there. It's objective. It's discoverable. We can do research and find it. So, I kind of thought that was more of a deflection than a really good argument against Davy's point that, hey, we need information to really undergird these systems.
Yeah, and in all fairness, Jeremy England is working within the confines of scientific materialism. So he assumes that everything in the world has to be explainable through a natural process. So if I were in that position, then I would say that England almost has to be right. In fact, you see this all the time in Origin of Life. They always appeal to emergence or self-organization to explain how you get to a chemical system, which is very, very different from life, to get to life. So there must be in their mind this self-organizational principles, these hidden properties of the universe that just push things in the direction of a cell. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's contradicted by all the physical evidence. And again, what also is the challenge is if you're in the framework of scientific materialism, you don't have in your toolkit the ability to identify design. You don't have the ability or the freedom to identify very special patterns that achieve functional goals because they're produced by a mind. So he has to, in a sense, ignore the fact that a cell looks like a nanotechnology device. It's just the technology is far, far more advanced than human technology. So the familiarity an engineer has with a cell is an intuition that he is not allowed to draw upon. That's the big challenge.
I like the way you've articulated that. And in some ways, Davies struggles with the same thing, right? He was asked by Brierley about his view, meaning Davy's view, that there's some principle that must exist out there in the universe that could generate this information. He talks a lot about information. He recognizes that, but he still thinks there's some principle out in the universe that's going to generate it and drive this chemical system toward life. What was Davy's response to that?
Davy's basically said he believes that because he wants to believe that. Just yeah. Philosophically, he wants to believe that there's these underlying principles in the universe that produce life. But he's very honest about the fact that there is absolutely no evidence to support that. There's no physical process that even remotely does what he believes it has to do. So again, and he was also very honest about the fact that he wants to believe that because he doesn't want to believe in the possibility of some higher intelligence. He doesn't like the idea of there being a creator. So he's chosen to confine his search to something that's philosophically acceptable.
Well, it's a really interesting approach. I, again, appreciate his candor and his honesty in that regard, but it's, you know, in some ways it's also sad that, and maybe we all do this to some extent in our lives, but certainly in this area of Origin of Life, there seems to be a real emphasis on avoiding any possibility of an intelligence involved in the process. And it's not following the evidence where it leads. It's just taking this philosophical stance and saying, I'm going to take that approach.
And I think you see this same tension in all great scientific revolutions. So if you look at, let's say, going from the geocentric view of the world, where the Earth was the center of the entire universe, to a heliocentric view of our solar system, that the Earth goes around the sun, there was a lot of resistance to that change because people were very much wedded to like the Ptolemaic system, Aristotle's philosophical foundation there. And they just so wanted to keep the world in a philosophical framework that they were comfortable with, that they were willing to produce epicycles and all sorts of very complex patchwork theories to preserve their philosophical framework. But as soon as people were willing to step outside of that framework and look at it from a different vantage point, things made so much more sense with the heliocentric view of the world. And I'm simplifying the situation greatly, but I think you see my point.
Yeah.
Same thing now. is that we are really at the verge of that next great scientific revolution, because with Origin of Life, you see this nanotechnology that couldn't have been produced by any natural process. So either you have to appeal to very mysterious physics that has no basis in reality, or you have to change your philosophical assumptions. And the challenge is to argue that there's some underlying physical principle that will produce life is very much similar to saying that you don't believe that cars were produced by engineers, so you assume there must be some physical process in tornadoes that produces cars. Mm-hmm. It's that same sort of tension.
Yeah, yeah. I like the way you've articulated that. That's an interesting analogy there. One of the things we've talked about in the past, Brian, is James Tuer's work looking at the origin of life research that's going on and articulating some of the challenges and the difficulties with that. In this conversation between England and Davies, the question came up about whether we are making progress in origin of life since, say, Miller-Urey in the 1950s. And I think, you know, my view is probably similar to James Tuer's, that there has been very little progress in that regard. England replied to this by saying, well, you know, there's been progress because we're learning a little bit more about how a membrane might form, or how some kind of a bubble might work as a vesicle, or how some nucleotides might be put together. And so it's not fair to say that there hasn't been progress in the origin of life field. There's actually been some decent progress. What's your view of his articulation of that versus, say, what James Tuer is arguing?
Well, I think in general, big danger is when people read about origin of life research, but they don't read the actual research themselves. Hmm. Because the way the origin of life research is often presented in the press or even in academic circles that aren't specialists is the idea that we've done this experiment and lo and behold, we have some amino acids linking together, or we see a RNA that will reproduce part of itself, or we see, let's say, a vesicle form of lipids that is kind of like a cell membrane. But what you realize when you actually read the primary literature, the actual journal articles, is the reason all that happens is because of the experimental's genius. What they do is they create incredibly precise chemical conditions, physical conditions. They add the right reagents. They have the right temperature. They change conditions in the right time in the right way. And they may have like dozens of steps that essentially force the chemicals to meet certain goals, to create certain structures or to produce certain molecules. So I would say that Origin of Life research has made tremendous progress, but that progress is in showing specifically why information and intelligence was needed at the origin of life.
Yeah, I think I love the way you've articulated that. My view would be that we've made progress in understanding what won't work from a materialistic standpoint. If you look at essentially all of these studies, as you say, there has to be incredibly precise protocols and things in place in order to get just one minor step to go to the next minor step. And so it really highlights why pure chemistry and physics will not work. We may be making progress in the sense that we are moving closer to be able to design some of these systems. But that's a very different thing than saying that we've shown how it could happen on the early Earth in a purely natural environment, which is really what Tuer's focused on, where his criticism is emphasized there.
Yeah, and the great irony is physicists could have basically predicted the results of Origin of Life experiments, the ones that try to accurately portray a model of the early Earth, 100 years ago. Because all natural processes, all organic reactions, if you take any set of organic chemicals and maybe some other molecules, and you shock it with electricity or you apply any other form of energy, we know that what's going to happen is that the arrangement of molecules are going to tend to be those that have the lowest free energy. They'll tend to have the lowest energy in the chemical bonds, and they'll tend to be in disordered arrangements, like a tar. Mm-hmm. So what you see in, let's say, the Stanley-Miller experiment or the Miller-Urey experiment or any other experiment is exactly what you'd predict. You get a lot of junk. You get this intractable mixture of organic compounds, most of which are either simpler or low-energy tars, and you get a very, very small amount of anything useful for life. But that's where the experiment ends, because you'll never have those trace amounts of organic compounds that are useful for life linked together in long chains, because there's so many other reactions that could also take place.
Yeah, and so what we're seeing is really a vindication of what physics would have told us from day one if we had taken it seriously. Well, Brian, this has been really helpful. Just as a final takeaway, what's your view as you've studied origin of life research and done some writing and debating in this area? What's your view of where origin of life research is pointing? Are we growing closer to a naturalistic scenario that's plausible, or are we pointing more and more toward the need for design?
Oh, that's a great question. In fact, let me use the analogy I used when I was being interviewed by James Torr on his show. And it's, you can imagine that, let's say, a group of scientists find a spaceship that's crashed in Area 51, and they want to understand the spaceship. And what happens is half the scientists, for whatever reason, refuse to believe in the possibility of aliens. They just assume it has to be produced by some natural process. But the other group of scientists believe that it could very well have been produced by aliens. So they go about studying the spaceship in very different ways. One group will try to envision natural processes to produce the spaceship parts. So they imagine that there might be some molten lava from a volcano, the metal separated, and then you have this metal ore that falls into crevices of rocks, and then those crevices just happen to be the right shape to produce spaceship parts. And then a tornado brings all those parts together and arranges them in the right way, or an earthquake. And obviously, they'd make very little progress. And that's exactly what you see in Origin of Life. All these attempts to explain how you would get the building blocks of life in a local environment will fail because they violate the most fundamental principles of physics and chemistry. Well, the other group of scientists, what they'll do is they say, let's apply our understanding of engineering to the spaceship. Let's look at similarities between what the spaceship does and, let's say, airplanes or cars or something along those lines. And then they could make enormous progress because as they look and ask the question, what purpose do these spaceship parts serve? They'll then understand why they're connected to other parts in a certain way. They'll understand their function. They'll understand their interrelationships. Mm-hmm. In the same way, the people who will make the most progress in understanding minimally complex cells are those who look at it from an engineering perspective. What are the minimal functions that are needed? How do those functions interrelate? How does information processing work? And what engineering principles are being employed? And that's just not true in the origin of life, but that's true with all of biology. So you look at systems biology, and the people that are making progress in understanding life are asking the question, what functions do these entities serve, and what engineering principles are in play? So that is both the future of the origin of life and the future of biology.
Excellent, excellent. Appreciate that summary. Thanks for being with us today, Brian. It's been really helpful to have you walk us through this conversation between England and Davies and help us understand these issues a little bit better.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of ID the Future. For more information about the origin of life, join us again at idthefuture.com or on your favorite podcast app of choice. Consider sharing a link with a friend to help them also understand this important information. For ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson. Thanks for listening.
Visit us at idthefuture.com and intelligentdesign.org. This program is copyright Discovery Institute and recorded by its Center for Science and Culture.